Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. It is Monday, November 18th. This month marks 3 years since fuel turned up in the Navy's drinking water system. We hear from investigators with the Department of Defense Inspector General's office. We also hear from the Navy's own former fuels director, who after raising concerns about the facility, was transferred out of her job. In the wake of recent natural disasters, healing is the focus of an upcoming summit on the University of Hawaii campus. We talked to a Hawaiian Studies professor about what indigenous knowledge can teach us about natural disaster recovery. And we'll learn about a new art project that will replace the reflecting pools at the State Capitol building. It's a solution to a very expensive leaky problem. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It was 3 years ago that multiple users on the Navy's water system called 911, worried about the heavy smell of fuel in the air. The calls came from multiple neighborhoods, from civilian families living in Foster Village to military dependents concerned about what they were smelling from their homes in the Aleomanu Military Reserve. Take a listen.
Fire department, I just have an emergency.
Hi, I smelled like fuel, like diesel fuel. I live on AMR, and it's a very strong odor. You come outside and you can smell it.
Okay, hold on. Let me get in touch with the Fed fire dispatcher. This is the fire department, address of your emergency.
Well, I live in Foster Village, and There's some kind of smell. I'm not sure if you guys got a couple calls from that.
What kind of smell is it?
What kind of smell is it? Like gasoline? Like gasoline. What is the other one?
Diesel. Oh, like diesel. Okay. Somebody that's in, you know where AMR is, the crater?
Uh-huh.
They are reporting an odor of diesel also. I mean, they look like they're nearby, but kind of far away, so I'm not sure where this diesel is coming from. We're calling the military to see if they know what's going on right now, but if you want a truck to come to you, if it's strong where you're living, I mean, where you are right now, we can start there and see if we can locate something.
Those 911 calls were among the first signs that something was not right at the military's Red Hill Underground Fuel Storage Facility. This morning, we talked to the Department of Defense Office of the Inspector General. It released a report on its findings that led to the jet fuel getting into the drinking water and affecting some 90,000 users back in November of 2021. Many military families were forced to leave their homes, seeking refuge in Waikiki hotels. Jamesia Blunt is the program manager in research and the environmental division. The report looked at three things: the military's fuel and water system at Red Hill, as well as at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam. It looked at the mismanagement at the Red Hill facility and the lack of emergency response to the spills there. And a third report included some 38 recommendations to prevent any future problems.
So we talked about the challenges of the management and the oversight of the fuel infrastructure, the improper management and installation of a fire protection system at the Red Hill bulk fuel storage facility, which led to a series of fuel incidents, and then the mismanagement of the response to the fuel incidents, one of which contaminated the community water system. So that's pretty much the overarching message of the first report. The second report, which we call the water report, picks up where the fuel report left off. Talk about the mismanagement of the response to the contamination of the community water system, and how the Navy did not effectively communicate the risks to drinking water users, which impacted a lot of people, as you know, and as your listeners know, thousands of which were displaced from their homes, experienced medical issues, and had to collect alternate water for drinking and for other uses. We also found systemic issues with the operations, maintenance, and management of the community water system, which contributed to that contamination incident. So the third report is actually a management advisory, which is a little bit different than our typical reports. A management advisory is a shorter, more targeted report that allows us to say there is something that we think you should look a little further into. And so that's kind of what we did for the third report. It is a management advisory that discusses the Navy's handling of incidents involving a fire suppressant foam containing PFAS, which, as some people may know that are listening, the EPA designated as a hazardous substance in May of this year. The third report details that Navy officials could not provide us with evidence that they completed the required incident response actions, including reporting or properly cleaned up the affected areas for three incidents that we discussed within the management advisory.
Since it's been a few days since this became released publicly, we want to look forward. You know, what is still outstanding? What are you recommending that the Navy do to keep our system operating safely?
So still outstanding from the Navy standpoint, obviously, is the closure of Red Hill, which is ongoing. It is outside of the scope of the reports, but we did kind of touch on the fact that it is happening. However, across the three reports, we made 38 recommendations to the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of the Navy. The overarching themes of our recommendations were, first, you know, making sure that the management of the systems, both the fuel systems and the water systems, was clear and understandable and had a single point so that everyone knows who they're following and how they're getting the mission done. The second theme for the recommendations that we had in the report was basically to make sure that our procedures are clear and understandable and that we know what to do to operate both the fuel and the water systems. Similarly, the third theme was making sure that we have the policy and the procedures and the exercises in place to make sure we know how to respond to an incident. And then in the actual AFFF report, we kind of had a fourth theme, if you will, that targeted us making sure that we are doing the proper reporting for cleanup of any incidents that we have. So we kind of covered the gamut there in terms of, one, making sure that we know who's in charge to make sure that we're not having these same incidents in the future, and then knowing how to operate the systems safely and effectively so that we don't impact people, the mission, or the environment. And then third, if we do have an incident in the future, which we're hoping we don't, how do we respond to that incident so we can minimize the impact to all involved?
You came up with these recommendations based on the deficiencies that led to the spill 3 years ago. Are you confident that the Navy's other systems are being operated safely, that we do or will have people who know what they're doing?
I want to just kind of step back and say that the scope of our project was very targeted to the Defense Fuel Support Point, Joint Base Port Harbor-Hickam, including the Red Hill. Although we did visit about three other locations, either virtually or in person, I don't have enough data to say something like that about all of the DOD systems. I can really only speak to the one that we look the most at, which would be Defense Fuel Support Point, Joint Base Port Harbor-Hickam. I can say that we have been working with the Navy for the last couple of months to get together a plan on how they're going to move forward with the recommendations. So I'm confident that the DOD and Navy are looking forward to the future and looking to try to make sure that they are enacting recommendations that will help them make their operations safe in the future.
One of the things that your report did flag was the lack of, I guess, oversight. You know, it wasn't being managed properly. I don't know if the work wasn't being checked. You know, we didn't have a proper emergency response. And, you know, there were issues flagged with the use of PVC pipes versus metal in an industrial facility like this, even though the contract called for the stronger pipes. How do we rectify that? I mean, I don't know whose kuleana that is, whose responsibility it is. Is it the contractor or whoever was running the facility at the time who signed off on the use of those pipes?
So I think that goes back to the recommendation that I was talking, the recommendation theme that I was talking about before. One of the things that we talked about is the communication between all the entities that were in charge, if you will, of the facility was not there. There was not a single point that was in charge to make those decisions and make sure that we were catching things across all the different organizations that have a hand in the operations at Defense Fuel Support Point, Joint Base Pearl Harbor-Hickam. So I think that implementing the recommendations that we have that are aimed at identifying who's in charge for the fuel systems and for the water systems will help make sure that we don't have anything like that in the future. It will also improve the communication between those organizations to make sure that we don't have those miscommunications like the DOD had with the improper materials and the fire protection system.
With this report, is this it for your office? You know, because we know that there were other reviews of the situation, some maybe not as thorough as they should have been. And so we've had multiple eyes on what happened and what led to this problem. So will there be any additional reports coming out of your office?
So I can speak for the evaluations component of my office, and I'll take a step back and say that the DOD OIG has multiple components. Some components do audits, some do evaluations, some do investigations, and we have separate lanes for a purpose. And what I can say is that for the evaluations component, it's the end of reports at the moment. However, it's not the end of our contact with the DOD and the Navy about the recommendations that we have in the report. We have in targeted, and we have a proactive recommendation process where we follow up with the evaluated entity to make sure that they are enacting the recommendations and that the recommendations can benefit the DOD community. So we will work closely with DOD and Navy officials as they close out the recommendations over the next coming years.
And one of the recommendations is that you have someone with some petroleum background, or at least a point person who understands the system. And the Navy did have a fuels director at Red Hill, Lieutenant Commander Shannon Bentz. So she was removed from her position and cut out of the response. If she shared information, I mean, how much did that help you in compiling this report?
So we talked with several people at DFSP, Joint Base Pearl Harbor, from all the different organizations. I mean, everyone was very helpful in making sure that we understood the technical aspects of the operations, the maintenance, and safety. And then I'll take another step back and say, you know, my team is very targeted in doing an evaluation, a technical evaluation. We're a team of engineers. So we were looking at the system from an engineering standpoint to make sure that the operations, maintenance, safety, and the oversight from that technical view were in line with federal and state and DOD policy. So I can say that everyone that we talked with at the Navy, DLA, and other DOD organizations were very helpful in making sure that we had the correct technical knowledge of the systems at DFSP, Joint Base Pearl Harbor-Hickam, and the Joint Base Pearl Harbor-Hickam Community Water System.
You know, we have had military officials in our studios who have said that the facility at Red Hill was being operated and was meeting or exceeding state and federal standards. But, you know, your report certainly highlighted deficiencies in the management and operation and emergency response. You know, our listeners may want to know, will anyone be held accountable because of this catastrophe?
So I will go back to my previous answer there and say we were doing the technical evaluation. So the job of our reports were really to kind of lay out what happened from a technical standpoint from the beginning to the end and do a very fact-based examination of what happened and how we can prevent it from happening in the future and how we can correct the deficiencies that we saw. In terms of holding anyone accountable for what happened during 2021 and 2022, that's outside of the scope of our evaluation, so I couldn't speak to that.
Okay, but that would have to come up higher in the chain?
Higher or different, yes.
Anything else that you would like to underscore about this report and just the complexity of the situation that you had to evaluate to understand what was really going on? Because it sounds like there were some real systemic problems there.
I will definitely say it was very complex. The facility is large. It has three distinct operational areas that are all interconnected across the entire base there at Joint Base Pearl Harbor-Hickam. And there are a lot of laws, both federal and state. There's a lot of policy for each of those things. You know, the fuel has its own distinct set of policy. The water systems has their own distinct set of policy. And sometimes those policies don't necessarily talk to one another. So it was very complex in first learning the policy and the laws for each of those areas, and then kind of identifying those intersection points and then talking with the knowledgeable people about those laws and policy to figure out, you know, where their gray areas, what's fairly clear, what's unclear, so we could identify where those deficiencies were coming from that we discussed in the report. So it was definitely very complex. And, you know, I think we discussed it there in our report about the number of policies. You know, I think there was over 240 different policies that we reviewed alone just from the policy standpoint. And we had a lot of requests for information from the DOD. We held about 95 interviews with DOD officials. We did the two site visits in 2022. And in addition to talking with DOD and Navy officials, we met with officials from the EPA, the Hawaii Department of Health, the University of Hawaii. So it was a very, very complex system. It was a lot for my team to evaluate. So definitely a complex system and definitely something that we think was very worthwhile to help highlight those deficiencies so that the DOD can improve in the future and we don't have anything like this happen again.
That was Jamesia Blunt, Program Director of the Research and Engineering Division in the Office of the Inspector General under the Department of Defense. That division interviewed close to 100 people and conducted two site visits in compiling this report.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
The world takes you outside your borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble.
We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stay with you for a lifetime. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global news and inspiring voices that will keep you on top of the world.
Listen each weekday.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
We also reached out to Lieutenant Commander Shannon Bentz, who served as fuels director at the Red Hill Underground Fuel Storage Facility. She's currently serving at Marine Corps Base Hawaii after her superiors transferred her out of Red Hill following her complaints about the operation there. A previous after-incident report indicated she was the last remaining person with fuels expertise, and she told us she was cut out of the emergency response. She feels vindicated by this latest Inspector General report, and while she had filed a separate complaint with the U.S. Justice Department on a false claims act against defense contractors, that department opted not to go forward with her concerns. But Bent says she was interviewed by the Inspector General investigators, and she hopes she helped them understand the systemic problems she tried to flag to her superiors and others.
So it's very validating. However, what didn't come out of the report was the accountability. Who is going to be responsible for all this mismanagement, the non-maintenance that occurred at the Red Hill Fuel Facility, the training, which was documented to not be enough for these operators and managers of the facility, and also even the officers above me, was not a requirement to know anything about fuels or petroleum operations. So a lot of these were known facts to leadership. However, I think rank and abuse of power got in the way of a lot of these operations.
One of the recommendations from the IG report is that they have a fuels officer in charge. And I'm scratching my head because you were the fuels director of Red Hill.
That is what I should have been. Again, I was fuels trained. I went to school. The U.S. Navy sent me to University of Kansas to get a petroleum management degree, master's. And also part of that is getting an engineering certificate to understand fluid dynamics. So I should have been that single subject matter expert. And so the thing that there could be another all-around fuels expert that is the single point of contact person in charge. However, the military isn't set up that way. It's set up by rank. And so orders are taken from those appointed over you, lawful orders. So that's something that needs to be really thought through. I don't know if they agree to it or not. It is definitely a recommendation, and I concur with that recommendation. You know, you should have a fuels expert that knows, well, what I've been saying all along for the last few years, a petroleum engineer that knows systems inside and out, and that's your expert. And that person makes recommendations to senior leadership.
And do you recall the night of the spill, May of 2021?
I do. You know, I was cut out of communications, so that's definitely something that could happen in the future, again, by senior officers making the calls, even though there's documentation that the fuel director is in charge with the emergency response personnel and the Navy on-scene coordinator. Even me and that Navy on-scene coordinator person was cut out of the game throughout this spill response. And so that does not help, you know, when the military is controlled by people that outrank you. So
and you follow orders.
And I follow orders, lawful orders.
Well, you also did try and file a complaint of False Claims Act with the Justice Department about what was going on with the contractors. For whatever reason, the IJ did not pursue that. But do you feel, though, some vindication with this IG report that it has flagged some of the problems that you yourself tried to get other people to pay attention to?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the False Claims Act is really another waste, fraud, and abuse avenue to go after people that should be responsible and held accountable. I really saw after I worked there for, you know, close to a year that, or less than a year, that the contractors were, they had open kimono access to the facility. They were making calls and calling shots without any government approvals. They were not doing maintenance. It was really the wild, wild west. And so I really saw that, and I still think that they have most of the accountability. But as you can see by the IG report, there is some government fault and mismanagement, and I think it has a lot to do with these people, these civilians and senior officers not being fuels trained.
So they're basically running the facility and the Navy isn't checking the work or properly overseeing what was happening at the facility.
Yeah, so how can you check the work if you are not trained in petroleum engineering to validate contractors that have certifications in petroleum engineering such that, like, they're able to, some quals include American Petroleum Institute 653 and 570, where they can inspect pipelines and tanks and know the specs in which they are supposed to be repaired to. If the government's not trained to do that, how are they going to check the contractor?
And one of the things that the report flagged was the installation of PVC piping as opposed to industrial grade metal pipes that should have been used in the first place. The report says that the contract called for it, but for whatever reason, they opted to get stuff off the shelf.
Yeah, so that was very interesting. So even if the contracting officer on the Navy side signed off on that with the contractor, if that's what happened and the contractor installed PVC, which they did, it's still against the law because you're talking fire codes and U.S. code and federal codes that are for facilities. There's certain things that and laws that you don't break because it's happened before. You know, you install PVC and there's a fire, it's going to melt or it's going to break down or something's going to happen to where there's a giant mishap. And so that's why these laws exist. So even if the contractor or the contracting officer on the Navy side approved it, they didn't have the authority to do that.
Right. Standards are there for a reason.
Absolutely.
So what's your hope, given that, you know, this report has shown that obviously Navy wasn't doing proper oversight. What's your thought? Now that you've seen this report, it validates some of your complaints. What do you hope will happen next?
Not only did it validate that Red Hill is a problem, they validated that it's other fuel facilities under Navy control and throughout the military that have issues and very similar issues. So my hope is that they finally get petroleum engineers and people certified in petroleum operations, that they hire experts to read and understand Red Hill, even call me. I haven't been ever contacted by Navy, even though I know Red Hill inside and out. I think
you've offered.
I've offered. So that's what needs to happen. I hope that they take this to heart, and if their operators cannot get trained because they don't understand the material to, you know, understand the U.S. codes that exist to keep facilities safe and operations, then they need to hire new ones and trained ones to make these facilities safe.
One issue is accountability. Many people are wondering, with what's happened, the admiral's really only got a slap on the wrist. What are you hoping will happen when it comes to accountability when all this is said and done?
Yes, so I think they need to go back in time. Obviously, this didn't happen overnight. It's been happening for decades. And over time, it just blows my mind again that I'm the only one that spoke out and raised the alarm bells when there was officers that even outranked me that been in that facility, again, for decades, going back in time throughout NAVSUP, NAVFAC, DLA, the different organizations that had their hands in it. I think they need to go back in time and hold every single one accountable that knew of and didn't say something or hold anyone accountable through that time period.
We've heard the possibility that someone would get court-martialed, but that hasn't happened. And the admirals have been allowed to retire, you know, with no reduction in rank or pay or anything like that. Like I said, it's not over yet, but I know one of the investigative reports did note that when they transferred you out of that facility, you were the last person with any kind of fuels background at the facility.
Yeah, so I think also in the report it said there was multiple opportunities that the Navy missed in which this was all preventable. I really think I was that missed opportunity because I kept making more reports and I kept going straight to my captain and doing what's called Article 138, it's wrong against the CO. Again, all written documentation, the Navy IG, the DOD IG to Congress, you name the organization, I went to them. And those were all missed opportunities, and we really got to get better. But the good thing about being active duty is that you can be recalled from retirement and court-martialed. So I'm still hoping that occurs for those involved.
How much do you think being a woman in a facility like that, you know, mainly a male-dominated space, had anything to do with what happened with you?
A lot. I think I have to work 10 to 20 times harder to get the same credibility as a man. And, you know, we're talking like I almost have 20 years of service time. And when the opposite sex walks into the room, they just take their word. You know, this is just my opinion, but being a woman in the military is really hard because you're there's not a lot of us, and I think that was kind of what the Navy did wrong too, because they didn't take my credibility as all the rest of the people that worked there. I worked harder, and I read, and I made myself smart. And when I went to work at the Red Hill Fuel Facility, it was a challenge. I just never thought I would be seeing things that I should probably not have been seeing. And I was appalled when I found out, especially about the fire suppression system, that it wasn't even working, that I was being expended and the rest of the workers going into that facility were going in that facility when people knowingly knew the system didn't work, knowing that we weren't protected and we could have died. And I guess that's all around with all the different systems throughout Red Hill, is that I just cannot believe that Navy officers or officials above me allowed me and my workers to go inside that facility.
You were at risk.
We were all at risk.
That was Lieutenant Commander Shannon Bentz, who has been called a whistleblower for trying to flag the dysfunction at the Red Hill Bulk Fuel Underground Storage Facility. She is currently a supply officer at Marine Corps Base Hawaii, a job she says she loves. We asked if the military asked if she would take a position back at Pearl Harbor. She said she might consider it.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, home of the Tigers, McKinley High, and Modern Art includes work by Imai Kalani Kalahele, Keiichi Kimura, John Young, and more. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Nothing is just black and white or red and blue. In North Carolina, Donald Trump won their electoral votes, but Democrats swept major statewide races, including governor. What happened?
There's only one person who can really be Donald Trump, and that's Donald Trump. Others who brand themselves in that style, I think, just have a much harder time gaining traction.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
What can Hawaii's ancestral knowledge teach us about healing from natural disasters? That's the focus of the upcoming PO Summit on the University of Hawaii campus. Community organizers, scholars, activists, and survivors will explore how communities can rise again and demonstrate resilience in the wake of devastating events. Hawaiian Studies professor Kamana Beamer organized the conference. The Conversation's Russell Subiano sat down with Beamer recently in our studio.
When we think about what we can learn around healing from natural disasters, our ancestral sense of place and kuleana and the social ties that we have to each other oftentimes are overlooked today. You know, in our contemporary society, people are rushing. It's a struggle to get by. Periods of crisis and disaster are moments where we can collectively gather together and try to heal. And so this year's PO Summit, Hulihia Fire and Rain, Community Leadership Through Crisis. And so we're looking at what happened in Haena several years back, 2018, 50 inches of rain that fell in a 24-hour period, massive flooding. You know, the community was closed off from other aspects of Kauai for a while. And what we learned there is that that ancestral knowledge base value system was incredibly important for that community to push forward to a better state and to hold tight together. So yeah, our relationships to our place and each other are critically important for addressing the challenges that climate crisis brings us today.
I know that there's some documentation of Hawaii being hit by natural disasters in previous centuries. I've heard stories of Waipio Valley being hit by tidal waves.
Sure.
Is there recorded documentation of those events and the aftermath? Is there oli or any information or knowledge passed down through the generations about how Hawaiians recovered after those kinds of events?
Sure, yeah. There are, even in Hawaiian language newspapers, there's oral history accounts, Kaihina Ali'i, this one period of really massive flooding, for instance. And when we look at the ancestral system that's still in place, the lo'i, we're here on Oahu today. There's Pai Pai Ohe'ia. It's this, you know, the fish pond's 800 years old. Incredible friends of mine, you know, set their minds to restoring that fish pond over 20, 25 years ago. And you drive through He'ia today, combined with the work of the lo'i restoration that's going on, and it looks like a different place from when we were kids. But the infrastructure of that place, those fish ponds, those lo'i systems, they're 800 years old. So they survived multiple tidal waves. And so what I'm getting at is the ways that our ancestors modified, worked with the aina and the landscape was from observation of resilience over time, and how could they build to survive flooding, to survive tidal waves, so on and so forth. The lo'i system itself, you know, wetland taro fields, if you don't speak Hawaiian, a part of its infrastructure is really about spreading water across, you know, the landscape. So it mitigates fueling of water onto the reefs with mud and other things as quickly as possible. The Lo'i system itself, by expanding the waterways, slowing down the flow, holding it, it also helped to replenish the aquifer, you know, over generations. So what I'm getting at is, like, just that infrastructure itself, in many ways, was about feeding people, but it was about also being resilient to these kinds of periods of change and crisis. But the most important part is, again, the social bonds that we have for each other. You know, how we treat the Aina, how we treat each other. We're going to talk about that at the Pilo Summit. And, you know, the Kauai community, for instance, you mentioned these storms, Hurricane Eva, Hurricane Iniki, Dot before that, multiple tidal waves. So talking to the community in Haena, they said, you know, actually, we've had to respond to so many crises that when it happens again, they're more prepared. They're more resilient. They know it's all hands on deck. And these ancestral insights of how we care for each other, how we feed each other, whether you're Hawaiian or not, it makes sense for the place. And people have followed that, you know, and that's really what's helped that resilience. And, you know, luckily, we haven't had a crisis like this in urban Honolulu, for instance. I was on Kauai during Iniki. The hurricane was supposed to hit Oahu. All of a sudden, it turned, you know, it blasted us on Kauai. But we do have to remember, you know, that those ancestral ties to each other, even in urbanized Honolulu landscape, need to be at the forefront of our climate crisis resilience efforts.
The panel discussion that you mentioned about the Kauai rain bomb, I remember that term being thrown out at the time, but the Kauai floods in 2018, that panel discussion is very interesting to me because it seems like they have some knowledge and some experience that they can pass on to others who encounter similar disasters. What do you think Lahaina fire survivors, Lahaina leaders can learn from the folks in Haena that were able to recover and bring their community back after the floods?
That's exactly the conversations we're trying to tee up. And I can't tell you, you know, my tutu has Hawaiian homestead in Lahaina, in Lealii. My uncle, you know, lives there now, has that home. But I'm not of the Lahaina community. I'm not a kupa to Lahaina. So I won't tell you what the Lahaina community can learn. But we're trying to tee up those conversations. Like, what can we learn as a collective for Hawaii when it comes to these crises that, you know, lucky the rain bomb didn't take any lives. I mean, you know, realistically, floods can take lives just like fires. But we certainly can learn from how that community galvanized and responded. And, you know, I was just talking with Uncle Chipper Wickman, who will be there, Billy Kinney and Lei Wan. And, you know, Uncle Chipper said the so-called rain bomb, in some ways to them, they saw it as a gift. It was like, you know, Akua helping them to reset, to rethink, to flush, to purify. And when they came out of that crisis, you know, they fundamentally changed the way tourism works in Haena. You know, I went there as a keiki, as a kid, and it was just more and more cars, more and more rubbish, pilau stuff, you know. And today, it's one of the few examples that I've gone to, and I'm 46 now, where I've actually gone and I thought, oh my God, this place got better. You know, this place got better from when we were kids. And so it's very inspiring. And yeah, the insights, they followed the ancestral wisdom of how to interact and be in that place. And I think you hear from the Lahaina community, they want a similar outcome. Listen to the community, listen to the ancestral wisdom. Now, Haena did a great job in somehow getting leadership at the legislature and other places to take on that vision. And I think it remains to be seen, you know, if leadership is going to listen to the community in the same way in Lahaina. But that's certainly one conversation we'll have.
When we think about how we're looking to improve the timeline for natural disaster impacts, there's preparedness and being better prepared. There's healing and recovery and learning to better navigate that process. There's also the rebuilding portion of the recovery timeline. How do we incorporate Indigenous knowledge into the rebuilding process?
Sure, sure. So let's think about that infrastructure that I talked about, the Lo'i systems, the Loko'i, their relationship to the ecosystems and place that they're in and how they were created. So we definitely, you know, can rebuild in alignment with the ecosystems of place. You know, an example is the capturing of water. when we do rebuild an area, how do we allow water to filtrate down into the aquifer? You know, so we're not paving over everything and water is just running onto the reef. When we rebuild, we also have to think about how we rebuild, replant the landscape. My cousin's dad passed away in the Lahaina fires. We've had so much loss, you know, and it's hard to, I still get emotional about it. You know, the night of the fires, I was sitting in my room, and all of a sudden I got a text from my uncle Keola, who's living in Leili'i, and he said, evacuating. And I thought, what is this? You know, and then I didn't hear from him for 3 days, and we started to learn about everything that happened, obviously, on the fly. But the reality is the Lahaina fires would have never happened if the Ulu Grove was still in place, if plantations hadn't dried and taken waters from that landscape for 100-something years. So these are the kinds of lessons that we can look at when we so-called rebuild is how do we restore the landscape, you know, the aina, the integrity of the place towards abundance. So it's not just about rebuilding for people and homes, it's about rebuilding for that whole community. And I think that's some of the lessons we can learn from.
In a lot of discussions I've had and in a lot of things that I've heard from not just Lahaina community members, but also just people who have come through natural disasters, when we look at Olelo No'iau, there's always that thought that when you heal the land, you heal the people. When we talk about healing from natural disasters, is there a priority? Is it the most important thing to address the land? And as we address the land, does that ripple effect to the community, or is there a different order of priority?
You know, I think we probably will have multiple perspectives on this. Certainly my perspective would be, yes, if we care for the aina, we care for the landscape, the ecosystems, it will make life better for the people. And not just me or you, but two generations from now, you know, three generations from now. And that's really what we have to be thinking. That's part of our ancestral wisdom, is it's not just about us, you know, it is about our ability to cultivate the systems that provide life in perpetuity, you know, for future generations. And so I do believe it starts with restoring the streams. It starts with replanting the dryland forest. It starts with understanding the Olelo No'iau, the ancestral wisdom that comes from that place, and then shaping our collective built environment around that. And actually, the beauty of that is that's like international best practice. That's really what the world, even in architecture today, they're looking at how do you build green? How do you capture water? How do you provide urban spaces that actually are regenerative, like a forest, you know, that provide oxygen back to the community? So it's a crisis, but there's this opportunity to do something that works for Hawaii, that works for the community, and that, you know, can be a model for other places in the world.
A lot of these thoughts and ideas will be discussed at the PO Summit. Can you let our listeners know when it is and how they can attend?
Yes. So our PO Summit 2024, Hulihia Fire and Rain, Community Leadership Through Crisis. It's at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, at the Aimin Center, right across from Kennedy Theater. We'll be there on Thursday, November 21st, starting at about 9:30. We'll have some food, beautiful mele from Raiatea Helm. And then we have an incredible international keynote, Dr. Leila June. She's an amazing academic and activist. She does work on, you know, indigenous systems in Turtle Island, or what we call North America today. And really looking at, you know, the regenerative efforts of, you know, the ancestors of the past of that place. It's free and open to the public. So if you'd like to register, go to kamanabeamer.com. And you'll see it right there on my landing page, the registration link for PO Summit.
Professor Kamana Beamer, thanks for coming into the studio.
Oh, mahalo nui. Thank you for having me.
That was UH Hawaiian Studies Professor Kamana Beamer talking with HPR's Russell Subiano. The upcoming PO Summit will take place this Thursday, November 21st, on the UH Manoa campus. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today. Water Water leaks have long plagued the Hawaii State Capitol building, and the reflecting ponds at the historic government structure have been the source of the water. The solution to the decades-long problem is to drain the poles and replace them with glass art. Here to talk more about the installation progress is HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, some of the stuff, some of the cool renderings, so I'm excited.
Yeah, it's going to be a big moment for the state capitol, as you know, they've been dealing with these leaking pools for several years now, and it's really shaping up as the State Foundation of Culture and Arts has contracted Native Hawaiian Solomon Enos, who has been tasked with designing this large-scale canvas. And the state is paying $11 million for this art project that will cover 54,000 square feet of the Capitol pools. And Solomon, he calls himself the conductor, waving his paintbrush and telling people where to place their dots. So they're literally going in there, placing their paintbrush dot by dot to kind of add to the texture, which being there in person, this large-scale canvas, he's working on it kind of like panel by panel. So it's a reflection or a symbolic reflection of the ocean to kind of capture the spirit of the Capitol. And people can actually take photos of their dots right next to the map, so you'll know where your dots are going to be at the Capitol pools. And the canvas will be on fabricated glass panels, much like the ones at Capitol Modern, the State Museum. And Enos drew inspiration of this art project from Queen Liliuokalani's quilt at Iolani Palace and trips across the Pacific.
One of the things that actually really inspired me was Queen Liliuokalani's quilt that she wove during the time of her imprisonment, where folks would send swatches or patches and she would stitch them all together. And I believe that quilt is still on display over at Iolani Palace. And it really is based upon this idea of taking a patchwork of all the near shore ocean and ocean resource areas, all our kahakai areas right across the Paiaina, and bringing them together, stitching Hawaii together and turning it into a singularity. So there's that level. Also, there's another level to the story where we talk about these forms and these fiery forms that really actually permeate around the areas where the pillars are going to be. And some of them are a little bit fiery, some of them are quiet because they're symbolic. We're talking not only about the oceans themselves, but when you dive down deep enough and you think about the islands themselves, deep below, there is fire under the water. And it's a narrative that we talk about, you know, the battles between Namaka'uka'i and Pele and Lohiau, and Pele stealing Namaka'uka'i's boyfriend Lohiau and fleeing down the island chain. And every single time Pele would make a home, Namaka'uka'i would find her and put out her fire. And they would go all the way down until they reached Hawaii Island. And even till today, we see the fire and the water clash. And we see that, we get reminded that these islands themselves were forged from this clash of elements. And that truly, we are living on the top of pillars, right? There are these vast pillars that extend into the ocean.
You know, you had mentioned that there was something similar at Capitol Modern, you know, the whole Haisam Museum. And yeah, they had a pool and they replaced it with glass art. And it just looks terrific.
Yeah, and even though that pool is much smaller than what it's going to be at the state capitol, you get to see how Capitol Modern has actually used the pool for its own benefit. Every first Friday, they'll have drag performers come and actually use it as a walkway, so people can also dance on it too. So it's pretty stable. So it's going to be really interesting to see what the final product is going to look like in 2026. But some information about the Capitol building. It's a pretty old building. It was created in 1965, designed by architect firm Belt, Lamon & Lowe, and architect John Carl Warnicki. And it was created to kind of represent the Hawaiian Islands. So the building itself, it kind of has this mixture of architectural styles of a brutalist international type of texture. You see those rough textures and those pillars, those eight pillars represent the eight main islands in Hawaii, and the capitol's reflecting poles is supposed to represent the ocean. So it's really supposed to capture the spirit of Hawaii. And unlike other state cap or U.S. capitol buildings, it kind of has that neoclassical style. So you kind of get that Roman Greek look to it with the symbolic the pillars and the white look to it. So our Capitol building is very different from other capitals across the U.S. But during a public comment period, there were people who were very happy about this new art installation, but there were others who weren't so happy about it. They were a little bit worried because they do want to keep kind of like the overall look of the architect and what it initially intended to have that water feature to it. I spoke with Bill Chapman, who's the dean of the School of Architecture at the University of Hawaii, and he said the glass panels would present its own maintenance problems over time.
I think the area, as you know, ceramic material, like any masonry material, absorbs heat. It'll actually make the small environment of the Capitol a much warmer place, and so it won't have that same feeling. Plus, sounds will resonate in a different ways. You know, there's a famous architectural theorist named Rasmussen who used to talk about aspects of architecture that are underlooked, and some of those are the feeling of it, the sound, the way light penetrates when you move through a building, and all that will be quite different. It will reflect sound in a much different way from water, and it won't provide this sort of background of the same sort. You know, I certainly don't want to in any way take away from the gifts of the artist who has been chosen to work on this, and I'm sure that his work is excellent, but again, I don't think it will fully address the spirit of the Capitol as it was originally intended.
Yeah, because you do want to honor what the architect, his design and what he had in mind. I mean, over the years, I know there were many ideas. Someone wanted to have fountains that, you know, had colorful lights. And anyway, that one was shot down. But there, lots of ideas on how to deal with the problem.
And you're correct about the ideas, too, because I've also spoke with other lawmakers who actually wanted kind of like this rocks feature into it to kind of make it look like the ocean. And then other folks were thinking of putting in a lo'i farm in there, but that would also cause its own maintenance problems. But I also spoke with Comptroller Keith Regan at the State Department of Accounting and General Services, and he says that the department is still fixing up the pool, but he said the glass panels are more cost efficient and easier to maintain than dealing with the leaking water issues.
The glass itself is designed to allow the water to pass through and underneath. So the way that the glass panels are designed, it does permit water to travel through and therefore not pond directly on top of the glass panels themselves where people will be able to walk on. Beneath that will be a drainage system that will then transfer the water out from underneath the panels. It's basically on a pedestal, if you can imagine how it would be designed. And so beneath the glass, there will be space, and then there will be a drainage system that will move the water out from underneath the panels. In terms of maintenance is really more or less sweeping and perhaps cleaning periodically with some sort of a application of some water-based cleaner. We will take our cues from the manufacturer in terms of how to properly maintain it and what does that schedule look like. But in terms of the actual work and maintaining it, we do have a crew of highly skilled and dedicated employees that work at the state capitol from our department who handle all the custodial work and the groundskeeping work of the facility. And they're very excited, frankly, about what this means for the capitol and how they're going to be able to play a role in maintaining such an important asset that the state will have at the end of the day.
Do we know when this art installation will be complete?
It will be complete by 2026. So next year, they're going to be starting the glass fabrication, and 2026 will be the installation.
Okay, yeah. Well, the Capitol building, I think, makes 60 next year. So will be lots to celebrate. But thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that is it for us today. Tomorrow we learn more about a film called Grace. It's about forbidden love in the 1950s. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Or listen to podcasts. Find us on Apple or Spotify or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.